told me that I was not economically viable. And yeah, I think it was 7 years. Sir, excuse me, how'd your loan work out? Did they give you a loan? He must be economically viable. There's a man with a smile on his face. He looks like a happy customer. That's what an economically viable person looks like. Economically viable. No.
Hey, good morning, Winter Park, and we would like to welcome you to our weekly program named Punkonomics. My name is Jesse Velez, and we have our resident host and Dr. Benny Balick. Say hello, Benny.
Hello, good morning.
Okay, folks, we're having a little bit of technical difficulties here, therefore, we're going to ask Dr. Balick to say hello again.
Hello again.
Ah, there we go. We got
second time lucky.
Yes, definitely. A lot of technical issues this morning, and you know what can I say? But
just like the world, the economy,
exactly.
All the technical issues.
And for those of you that don't know us and just tune in because you are flipping through channels, and all these other stations are playing ludicrous stuff or mindless chatter. We are here basically to let you know and make you aware of certain things that your politicians, your government, and, you know, your church-going people are telling you misconceptions and all sorts of other things just to keep you oppressed. And hopefully, by the time we get through with you, you will go out there and make some changes. Anyway, I'd like to also let you know that you are listening to WPRK 91.5 Winter Park, and this is the voice of Rollins College, the best in basement radio. Okay, Dr. Balick, and we were discussing about hitting the obvious, which is the fiscal cliff or curve, as some other people put it. And, you know, quite honestly, I personally think that it's just kind of a another type of propaganda to keep everybody scared and complacent and, you know, the obey type situation. Could you brief our audience here what the fiscal cliff is, and whether it's you know, the end of days or just something that we need to start taking care of business?
I'll try. I mean, first of all, you know, I mean, even just to take a step back, I was gonna crack a joke about, don't call me doctor, don't tell them I'm an economist, they're gonna switch a channel, right? So we do try and have a chat about this stuff. Here's the other things we've talked about in the past. The fiscal cliff, there's a lot of details, you could do research. I do try and post on our Facebook page what I kind of think are the interesting articles, the stuff that you won't see on mainstream media, especially because really I don't get it. I don't have cable even, you know, and I don't I don't want to hear what they have to say on MSNBC, on Fox, on CNN much, you know, on occasion something on YouTube, maybe, if it so happens. But there's a lot of information. It's a complex matter. But in this show, we're not gonna give a lecture. We're not gonna break it down like an econ class, God forbid.
Right. But you are talking about the webpage called Punkonomics, right? On Facebook.
Absolutely. Punkonomics. Yeah. We're punkonomics.org, where we aggregate our stuff. That's also where we upload the podcast of the show, depending on how quick I can get my act together and how many students are waiting for me in my office.
Yeah, you know,
later today, hopefully, or by the end of the weekend, I always get it up there. You can get it on iTunes. You can subscribe on other tools, Android. I'm an Android user myself. Search for punkonomics.org. You'll find us.
Right. And you know, I guess, you know, I sort of live in a cave. So, you know, they have this thing called podcast.
I'm a big geek, too, right?
Yeah.
I'm an early geek, you know, I'm 46, you know, like, I shout out to all those geeks and gamers out there. I played Star Trek on a mainframe computer in 1975. That's when the ships were made of wood and the men of iron.
Yes.
So, yeah, I do, actually. I don't really listen to radio much. I do listen to podcasts. I have them load up to my phone, and that's kind of where I get informed a lot. I think that's, to me, the main thing about social networks too. I have a bunch of interesting people, diverse people, as my friends say on Facebook. And I have mixed feelings about Facebook. Every week I want to leave it, but there's just no alternative. That's perhaps, you know, we call it network effect in economics. And a billion people are on it. Just, you can't compete. Though, hey, entrepreneurs out there, we need a better social network that doesn't mess up with our information and doesn't own us. But anyway, if you have a lot of good friends, and like me, and others like Punkonomics, you will get in your feed a good overview. It's like an editorial board, a good overview of the news. And unlike the mainstream media, ranging from, you know, Fox are obviously complete hacks, but New York Times is, you know, a little bit better, but the same model. Because who sits on their board? People forget, you know, weapons, General Electric, you know, weapons manufacturers, financial institutions, the usual suspects. So when you wonder, you know, why they don't really break the news, question authority, well, they are authority. That's why they don't.
Now, you know, there's, of course, President Obama did his first press briefing, and obviously enough, I listened to it, you know, even though I am sort of in the cave, but I stay informed. It seems like
they're... Yeah, you listen to C-SPAN, man.
I know. I do C-SPAN, but, you know...
video games.
Folks, I know C-SPAN is boring,
still.
But that's where you catch them at their lies,
true,
because
that.
The media's not helping, covering up whatever mistakes they make, or, you know, the commercials distract you, or whatnot.
Yeah.
Personally, I think C-SPAN is, but then again, I do have to thank Dr. Ballack, because he's slowly weaned me into the whole Facebook culture, and now I'm actually starting to read for a change. But anyway, getting back to the serious matter of it, yes, the fiscal cliff. What I have noticed is that, and I think more or less this is a theater type situation, the Republicans are now saying, oh, we're going to stand on the grounds and we're not going to you know, pass anything that's going to affect the top. And Obama, I got to say, he had a swagger when he walked up to that podium and all that. Hopefully, you know, he does what he talks about.
Yeah.
But it seems like they're going to be bumping heads. And at all this, you know, from a, you know, standby, you know, I look at him going like, okay, do we really have a problem? Do we have to worry about, you know, let me get the next plane ticket out of here before, you know, everybody starts crashing into the rich neighborhoods and, you know, stealing and all that. And what is the case about this?
Things are bad, yeah, and they're going to get much worse before, hopefully, they will get better. That's overall the case all over the world. I mean, a couple of days ago, actually, I was in a splendid mood, not anymore, because there was a general strike in Europe. They're precisely the people of Europe undergoing a similar political, economic policy as we are. You know, people think, oh, they're like some, you know, love. If you liberals think that Western Europe is some kind of, you know, Disneyland, you know, of happiness and justice, you know, and conservatives thinks it's, you know, Stalin's dream. It's neither. It's actually quite similar. The banksters are in charge too. They have some bigger limitations, perhaps. They're not allowed to go gung-ho as sometimes, you know, they do here. But frankly, fundamentally, it's not that different. And millions of people went into the streets. There were strikes, disturbances. Generally, the population was supporting it despite not having enough, you know, metros and trains to get to work and things like that. Precisely against austerity. against the notion that our problems, what is our problem, debt, what do we need to do, cut it. And that does not mesh with most economic theory, practice, experience, or anything. In fact, to place it for you, what drives me nuts is that, you know, we read the books about the Great Depression, you know, it was a big crisis, there were others like it. What really turned it into a Great Depression, what made the Great Depression great, if you will, was that in 32, a few years after the crash, kind of like really there's an echo here, you know, after the 2008 crash, there it was 29, a few years after, the proverbial 1%, you know, I think it's the best, like, you know, slogan in decades, perhaps, this, you know, 99.1. It's mathematically not precise, but it's good enough. Pursuing their personal interest at the expense of everybody else and the national economy imposed cuts. Right? And that's exactly kind of what happened in that time. And we were taught in school about, like, look at those, you know, I mean, what were they thinking? You know, what were they smoking, those bankers? I mean, why did they do it in 32? Why did they plunge the world into hunger, which brought about people like Adolf Hitler and world wars? Etc. Were they insane? Were they stupid? But we're smarter than that. We've learned from their mistakes. We know better. And lo and behold, here we are again, doing the same thing. And the answer is, I think, something I keep, maybe, you know, sorry if I'm repeating myself, is that people aren't trying to solve our problem. There's no concerted, okay, we have to make a compromise. We have to figure out what's the best way. They're not even trying. They're representing. They're bought by money. Because we have this insane finance system for politicians who spend the vast majority of their time. It's not that they're evil personally. You could put the saint in Congress. If you're not rotten, you're going to stay on the margins in that group of, what is it, 20? Let's be generous, 30 honest, good people in Capitol, on Capitol Hill.
Really?
Maybe roughly, you know. I mean, but those are the people you don't hear about. Those are the few crazy Republicans that Republicans don't listen to. You know, they're the few, you know, really left wing Democrats that Democrats don't listen to. Who voted against the bailout, for example, you know, stuff like that. But they don't get the money because they don't do what they're told by the masters, and therefore it's very hard for them even to get elected. If they happen to get elected because they have a wonderful constituency that gets them in there despite everything. They have no influence.
You know, I hate to say it. I think I'm much more cynical than you are because, you know, you're being nice. You're saying there's about 30 of them. I personally thought they were all crooks.
Yeah, no. Really, honestly, because you gotta respect them. You know, I even go on the limb these days, and honestly, I mean, I disagree on economics with a lot of the prescriptions of. Here I go again. My God, it's weird. Ron Paul. You know, I disagree fundamentally, but. You know, he's not corrupt. He does call it like it is. I have to respect him there. He's the only one who's famous. But there are others like him. A handful of Republicans, a handful of Democrats who do the call, you know, they're not on the take, above all, they're not getting money from the proverbial 1%, though in terms of really people who own the government, we're talking more like 0.001%. The billionaires, not just the, right. the little millionaires.
But don't you also think that the guys like Ron Paul, you know, and I do like Ron Paul. A lot of his you know, issues that he brings forward, I'm, you know, pretty much in accordance with him. But it seems to me that a lot of them are basically their agenda is not so much that they're being intellectually. How should I say, aware, and they want to change things. They come across more to me like they're ideologues. You know, like, you know, we're here and this is our mentality, therefore.
Well, you can't avoid it. We all have ideologies. You know, you can't avoid it. You can be, I think the best you can do primarily on biases, etc., you know, is to be honest about it. You know, I mean, I know that's, I do that in the classroom, and I think, you know, I often go to places that are really controversial. And most, you know, there's always a few, you know, that hate my guts. Hi there. Hello. You know who you are.
Yeah, shout out to that one.
The couple that really hate me. You know, and I'm sorry. You know, I mean, let me, you know, I don't hate you. You know, well, maybe. I don't know.
Actually, he's a puppy dog. He's a loving person. If you get to know him personally, you go like, what happened to that demon that was jumping up and down in classroom and telling us about all this and stuff? But
they know. I mean, honestly, they know. I mean, kids also, you know, kids can sniff fake from afar, you know. Right. So they know I'm honest about it. And if I disagree, I disagree. And I'm honest about my peculiar biases. And they're perhaps a little peculiar. It gives me an advantage that I'm not a typical, you know, liberal or Republican in any sense, you know, or conservative in any sense of the word. In fact, I straddle the two in some kind of strange way, but maybe we can talk about it later. But, you know, I care about making it work, and I respect people's opinions, even if I think they are vile, not let alone wrong. You know, I'm even vile. And there's a degree of trust, and I love the students who give me hell in class, and they appreciate it. You know, those who are right there, wait a minute, what did you say there? Check out me, come back, argue back. That's great. That's how we get to any kind of truth. Truth is a kind of a process. There is no truth with a capital T. I mean, okay, I'm not, wouldn't want to, you know, belongs in religious institutions. There you have absolute truth, and you can talk theology and philosophy. I'm actually interested in that as a historian. But in the practical, pragmatic world, you need the truths come, practical truths come out of argument, and they're fluid, and they change. And to get back to the fiscal cliff, problem is, fundamentally, debt, it's not the time to cut the debt. The time is to get employment, create jobs. That's the time. What we need to do. That's the fundamental waste and crisis we're facing, just like in the Great Depression. Is the budget deficit a problem? Absolutely it is.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be very careful to dramatically cut, because that would indeed push us into recession again and possibly beyond, into a depression. Of course, these are just kind of terminologies. If you're unemployed, long-term unemployed, you're already in a depression.
Right.
In fact, the unemployment now, if you measure it, it's such a measurement issue. But, you know, it's not that different than what it was at the peak of the Great Depression right now. So first of all, there's this fake focus on the immediate necessity of dealing with a deficit, and even more importantly, the idea that while, again, eventually we gotta deal with it, it will not solve our problems. It will exacerbate them. It'll make mm-hmm. them worse if we deal with it too quickly. So that's one thing. I gotta say, and this is, I heard that some of our listeners enjoy that when I slam into the president, and now that the election is over, and the other guy, the nutter, didn't. So yeah, let's not.
Yeah, that's not
equal opportunity hate in this show, right? Then we avoided, we dodged the bullet, and we didn't get the nutter and his team of merry men in power. But now we have our consensual, company man, bought and sold, mainstream Reagan conservative. By the way, if you want to get technical, Obama.
Don't raise my blood pressure.
In terms of his policies, he's a little bit more conservative than Ronald Reagan. We can maybe talk about how Ronald Reagan.
I agreement with you on that.
In '82, there was also a much smaller, but the scandal of fraud, you know, of mass financial fraud, the savings and loan, the older people might remember. Reagan nationalized the banks, sent them to jail, all right? Didn't do other reforms I would have liked him to do, but imagine today, who? I mean, it's like only socialist like Bernie Sanders. He's a nice guy,
yeah,
right?
That's a nice guy right there, Bernie Sanders.
He's a socialist, and he says it. He doesn't play around,
I love that guy. But I gotta say.
But Obama uses that shibboleth, to use the Hebrew, kind of, which is a very nice, archaic, biblical way to say BS. about like, well, the government is like a family. You can't, go into a deficit. The government is like a family. It's like saying, I don't know, a submarine is like my grandmother. It's not. It works completely different. The flow of capital is completely different. It's one of those things that is purely propaganda in the sense of, we have a Protestant kind of, in our culture, kind of a Protestant work ethic, a bourgeois middle class, which was so important for the rise of capitalism, and its decline is what's bringing fundamentally the end of capitalism, that you live within your means. You don't extravagantly get into debt and all of those things. And it's absolutely true personally, unless you're a member of the, right, of our job creator leaders, all those wonderful men in $3,000 suits who we mustn't insult and we mustn't cut their salaries. Right. They just take 30 years of growth and smoking up in a pipe, and then we give them some more. And
wait a minute, you're talking about the like the one guy that almost ran me over this morning and his little hot SUV Mercedes while I was riding my little scooter. Guess what? You had this little sticker that has Save America. Mm. How about saving some of us that probably wind up working for you and stop texting and pay attention to motorcycles and scooters? But anyway, as far as Obama is concerned, I see Obama. I mean, I saw that swaggered and, you know, I went like, okay, maybe this is the Obama that I won in the first term. Personally, and I'm cynical, he might be that Manchurian candidate. He might just this time around go like, hey, you know, we need to do this and that. And you and I sat and listened to Martin Luther King III Jr.
Yeah, great speech.
Last night. Incredible. You know, I have to say that, you know, in spite of this morning, and, you know, of course, Dr. Balak knows I'm a little bit agitated, but, you know, last night I felt like there is some hope out there. And, of course, this morning I get up and I'm reading through the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, which, you know, my therapist told me not to do early in the morning. but apparently...
Let me second that.
Yes, exactly, exactly. But for my understanding is that they're talking about, okay, the emergency unemployment compensation program is expiring. Well, you know what? Florida, for some reason, never extended that. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there driving or actually walking to try to get a job are probably saying, like, hey, I didn't get my check. So they're talking about that expiring, which supposedly is going to save $26 billion, okay, payments to millions of Americans. And also, they're saying, well, $65 billion would also be cut across the board for most federal programs. Now, it seems to me that if a person does not have help, okay, let's say this person lost his job and the economy is bad, and believe me, the job employment out there is horrendous. I've been out there. It's probably one of the reasons why I decided to come back and educate myself and have a better possibilities of getting a better job. But it seems to me that when you're cutting these federal programs, okay, and a person is out on the street, and I'm going to exaggerate right now, but this is the reality of things. There actually are people, individuals, whole families out on the street.
Hundreds of thousands
living under underpasses. Now, you're trying to tell me that by cutting off these programs, they're going to have an opportunity to go to an employer and try to apply for a job and have the possibilities of getting employed when they don't have money to buy razor blades or to take a shower or to even get to where they're offering the jobs. I mean, it seems to me that this whole plan, this fiscal cliff or whatever.
Unemployment, misery is good for our masters.
Well, of course, it elevates them because they can throw a bone
they can exploit you harder.
Exactly.
You know, we pretty soon we'll lose our 8-day work week. We'll have to send our children down the mines, like in the good old days. You know, I think it was on our Punkonomics Facebook page where I posted this horrible picture of work conditions in the mines. You know, and I kind of facetiously, cynically said, "This is what right to work looks like."
Right
to work. Right to. Screw over? I mean, is that acceptable, actually, FCC? I never remember. How do you, what's the right word to use to, you know, replace the, that, or...
Blah, 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 blah.
Maybe, yeah. Over.
Right.
People, you know...
But I'm getting, what does this all mean when they're talking about the need to cut straight across the board? I mean...
It's anti-cap. The element you describe, and then we go back to the big picture. So, you know, help me because, you know, I need all the help I can get to stay coherent. It doesn't get better with age. But it is anti-capitalistic class warfare, is what you hear. So I'm not criticizing capitalism. There, you know, nothing's perfect, by the way. Capitalism has its problems. It's kind of, I personally tend to agree that it's probably the best we got right now, you know? Though it should always be constantly questioned and improved, like anything else. If you sit on your laurels, like that's evolutionary thought teaches us that, you're invariably going to sink, because the environment invariably changes. I'm not talking about climate change here necessarily, just the general, the world around us changes, because it's the nature of the universe to change. And if we are unable to adapt, if we're just saying, oh, what was good enough for my granddaddy is good enough for me, then you are for
right,
sure.
Exactly.
Because it's not the same world that your grandfather had, and you have to adjust to it. But what you were describing, this notion of cutting the benefits for the poorest of all. If you're an honest conservative, then you take the position that, hey, I got this idea. We have this market-oriented method to feed the poor children. But too many conservatives today... And again, there are those who not, so, you know.
Right, sure.
I know you're out there, people,
and,
you know.
And I'm going to believe in what you're saying, because I know what you're about.
They want to solve the problem. They just have the tendency of thinking that there are good market solutions for it. The thing is that what is overwhelmingly out there is not that. So when we have 1 out of 5, that's 20% children in America who are malnourished, what do we do about it? I'm willing to absolutely listen to multiple, you know, that there's plenty of liberal silly solutions to it too, you know?
Right,
But this pre-revolutionary France argument of, if they don't have cakes, let them, you know, if you don't have bread, let them eat cakes, this complete disconnect, you know what happened to them?
Well, I got a sweet tooth, so I probably will go for the cake.
Crumbs, maybe, if you're lucky. Mm-hmm. You know,
a lot of whipped cream.
It's just bankrupt ethically, politically, economically. First of all, it's not really where most of the money goes. Where to even start? But wait, you know, so I don't go that. I want to avoid the trees, you know, and look at the forest a little bit here, because this is not, you know, an analytical. I did post a couple of things, and hopefully people do come around and post some more, and we have some, you know, alumni and students and friends who are doing it and posting it on Punkonomics Facebook, and I'm trying to branch into, you know, have it all on other places, you know. Busy man, what can I say? I'm doing my best. Help me out. You know, I want it interactive. I want people to post if they care, or rant, whatever you want.
By the way, what were you saying about getting some help? You know, for those of you that have a cell phone, and please go to a parking lot stop in a Starbucks or wherever before you use your cell phone while you're driving.
So you don't run down on the road.
Yes, yeah, so don't run me over. You know, I'm really a nice guy, even though I have a harsh opinion about almost everything. But you can't call us here at WPRK 91.5 at 407-646. Oh, what was the number? 2915.
Oh, yeah, I see it with
you. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's on the wall. I put on my glasses so I can see it.
So about this cliff. So it's kind of a commitment mechanism, right? So they couldn't figure out the budget, and they decided to make this some kind of unpalatable, horrible outcome automatically enact at the beginning of the year, horrible for all. They had, like, basically, you know, they put in there what necessary that's undoable politically for anybody, Republicans, Democrats, we'll see. Though some people, and I'm veering there sometimes, say, let's do it. Let's just go over it, Kev. I'll tell you why in a minute. So here you are. So what's going to happen? Varied opinion. I just heard Ron Paul actually saying that there's no way they're going to be in agreement. A lot of opinions about how it's going to go. But let's look at the two options, right? This is going to be a bifurcation. Are we going to go over the cliff? What happens then? Are we going to have a compromise? You know, to some extent, it would have to be bipartisan, or otherwise we go over the cliff. That's the whole idea of the cliff. It's an interesting idea. However, well, without going into too many details, one of the main characteristics, I think, of the fiscal cliff, if it gets enacted, if it happens, that is, if there's no compromise, is a big cut to military spending. No,
that's not a bad thing.
Exactly. Well, yes and no. What's the good thing about it? That's really why I like Ron Paul. I disagree with Ron Paul pretty much about everything, you know? Though, right. Again, not a kind of ideological, oh, you nasty libertarian, you. Right. No, in fact, you know, I think that change the system, you know, the anti-Fed thing, yeah, but not gold. You know, gold, you can't do a gold standard, you know. How about Corey was here a couple of weeks ago. He'll come back shortly. We have to talk about, he'll have to give a talk about, you know, energy. There's a very interesting idea about pegging the money to energy. But the bottom line that I like Ron Paul for is that he is one of the very few people, and Republicans hate him for it overall, who calls out the fact that the American economy has veered into an imperialist economy run by a military-industrial complex, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a Republican president who coined the term Eisenhower.
Sure.
He kind of got disgusted by it and quit. I wish he'd do something about it. That's what I have against
him. Right.
You know, you told us they're messing with us. You told us we're doomed. Well, you were president. Why didn't you help us?
Well, I'm sure on his way out, he probably was disgusted with the system, and while he was leaving, he got his little check and said, oh, okay, yeah, whatever.
Well, maybe, or some people, maybe he didn't want to get shot, you know? Probably the best conspiracy theory, if you will, about who shot JFK is that.
Right,
I mean, it's by far the best one, you know? And I say conspiracy theory, those who've heard the show before know that I don't mean it in a bad way. there is a threshold that I think that makes you a conspiracy theorist, but it's not too far from the truth, you know? It's just a little bit going over. Again, let me try and keep on topic. The problem with cutting military, which by now you should understand, I think is a splendid idea, given that we don't need this kind of spending, that the amount of pork and inefficiency, there's issues of revolving doors, the army doesn't even get the equipment they want to get the equipment the private contractors want to sell. And, you know, we have soldiers dying out there, getting electrocuted in subpar showers, you know, after dodging bullets in Iraq, you know, then they die because somebody made a profit and cut costs on their equipment.
I mean, right,
it's fundamentally corrupt in that sense, highly inefficient. But then all those jobs. So that's a danger here with the fiscal cliff that has to be as much as, you know, this is where I say, yeah, I want to cut military. But again, now all these jobs producing perhaps overpriced, unnecessary things for the army, mm-hmm. but these people are going to get fired. That's not the time to do a restructuring of that kind, possibly. So kind of overnight, I changed a little bit. I veered a little bit less to the gung-ho, what the hell, let's go over the cliff. Significantly because of that. And then there are other dramatic cuts. There's also a tax hike. I mean, not only the tax for the wealthy. The Bush tax cuts have multiple components. The idiotic, corrupt part of it was precisely cutting taxes to the very, very wealthy, which is one of the unnecessary and just wrong wars, in especially in Iraq, and even the way Afghanistan lingered on. You want to go in, come back out.
The graveyard.
And
of
people
empires.
Are talking about the other ones. Right. Yeah, right. And the other wars, and in Africa now, there's significant incursions, and that's Obama. So I'm sorry about that. You know, I'm quite the imperial tendencies the president has. All of these things. Combined with the Bush tax cuts, are really what got us into this hole.
Right,
over $1 trillion. Simply for billionaires paying less taxes and being even more billionaires.
Right.
You know?
But you know, on the other side, Dr. King.
But we'll pay too.
Dr. King last night brought up something that I've always believed, and you know, he was saying that we basically send out billions of dollars outside the United States to you know, help countries, and I'm all for helping everybody around the world. I mean, you know, I'm a humanitarian, I'm humanitarian. I'm not that.
No,
bad.
Not no. that. We're not actually helping. America is with the lowest to the.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is that a lot of that money doesn't really reach the people that need it.
Exactly.
And what he was saying last night was that very same money can be applied here to help the people here, which would, in my personal opinion, would generate the efforts of the people that are out on the street to go to school, to retrain, and to get back in the system.
And we're
flush
with money. We're not broke.
I know.
We're sitting on what? Last number I saw, and again, all, you know, by all means, go rant, you know, call me out, correct me, you know, because my addled brain gets confused sometimes. I believe it's at least $1.4 trillion are in basically in cash. I mean, you know, it's not like coinage, like I play video games, but not that often. I don't see a pile of golden coins somewhere in the, you know, in the guild vault. essentially in cash, unused, uninvested, not in any financial instrument, sitting in the banks. We gave it to them. Remember, we know when they tanked us, when Al Qaeda couldn't do it, mm-hmm. but Goldman Sachs did.
Oh, they should.
They're sitting on it, and so that could be already significant. That would be they could cut us a check, and solve a budgetary problem pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah.
But they're not. Instead, they're not investing in America because it's not a good investment. I mean, they know. You know, they just destroyed it. So you know, there's India, there's China, there's the Gulf states, and there's war. War is such a profit maker if you're among the 0.001. So that's kind of why we do it. So we have solutions again, but they don't want to pay that money back. I mean, why? We don't have to, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. You'd think maybe if they cared about the economy, they'd do something. And again, just like I said about conservatives, that there are many good conservatives that are really trying from their perspective, and I respect that perspective. You also have you have billionaires, you know? And you know, you have liberal billionaires like Soros. You have conservative billionaires like Bill Gates and his dad, who don't want to gut this country and transfer their wealth to some foreign bank account.
You mean like the Koch brothers?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sorry. You know, it's hard.
We got to call them out.
We do, because really, the cynicism there makes like a pre-revolutionary French aristocrat, you know, look good.
And while we watch our country go down the tubes because of a few that are just outright stealing, I kind of wonder, you know, with all that money, and this particularly goes out to Donald Trump, is how does he manage not to get a brand new hairdo? He's got money to completely replace.
Dude, as a punk, I appreciate it. You know what I'm saying? He's got a look going. You know, I think if I went, well, man, you need to get a really bad toupee. I think there's something going on there.
Yeah, if Donna wants to send me some money so I can grow some hair, you know, I totally appreciate it. It doesn't mean that I'm going to vote for him either. You know,
no. Nice sculpt. It looks good. Looks good, man. I'm such a hairy dude. I come from hairy stock.
So lucky, you know what I mean? But well, when until you turn 55 like me, then you're gonna start going like, oh my god,
I have my hair? A lot of hair on my head for my age, no doubt. But let's not talk about other parts of my body, right? There's always a balance, right? But yeah, so the cliff. You see, so the option of going off the cliff is that a significant amount of a massive cut, and the cut is way too big. It's catastrophic. It's going to push us to recession, no doubt. Maybe beyond, we're going to cut a lot of the military. We are going to stop the Bush tax cut, and it'll hurt a lot of people, by the way, because like I said, it's not only for billionaires. In that sense, it was terrible, but there's also a middle class and beyond element. So on the average, it's like $3,500 a family more. Of course, not just income. I mean, it's. Again, it's complicated. I don't even know this stuff. I'm not just saying it's complicated to kind of a cop out. You know, mm-hmm. A lot of people, intellectuals and, you know, professors will say, oh, it's complicated because they don't know. So let me say, you know, no, I don't know the details. But overall, it will hurt everybody. And that will be suppression. In fact, removing tax cut for billionaires has no depressing impact on the economy, because billionaires, they save. When they have an extra couple of billion or whatever, they put in the bank, or they buy foreign luxuries.
Or they write it off as a loss.
They don't drink more milk, you know what I mean?
Right.
But for the 99%, you know, so that includes even like people who are relatively well off, or certainly middle class, which is right now sitting at about, you know, 40-something for household income. So it's not rich being smack in the middle median, you know. It means that, I don't know, you know, if I had $1,000 more in my pocket, being irresponsible, I wouldn't save it for retirement, but counting on my kids there. Are you awake already?
Let me give you a word let me give you some words of wisdom. And in my culture, as well as yours, you know, we're basically brought up to a belief that we need to take care of our parents, and therefore our kids will take care of us. And I'm here to tell you, Benny, I came back to Florida thinking that I was going to take care of my parents, and boom, here came the Bush administration, and completely destroyed that. And now who's taking care of who? My parents. And just like millions of Americans, I mean,
we got to stick together, not just in the family.
From a cultural perspective, and, you know, I'm going to go into my field of psychology. From a cultural perspective, psychologically, what that does to people out there that were raised like me and you with the moral obligation to take care of your folks and not being able to do that, what happens is these people turn into manic depressives and they become useless to society. So, I mean, you're being impacted on all levels.
Because we're told it's our fault. You know, we're a failure. You know, I feel it. You know, we're a failure. How come? I went to school all those years, worked hard all those years, yet I'm just, you know, upper middle class, barely that, you know, and it's hard, and I don't know where I'm paying the bills, and I have no savings, so, you know, if my kids don't get rich, I'm going to have to live off of cat food or kill myself when I'm 60. Yeah, you know, I stay awake at night about these things, but the thing is that there is a conspiracy. It's not a specific group of people, Illuminati or Masons or whatever, you know?
Or bones and skulls.
It's a class thing. It's a class thing. Now, again, there are people at the upper classes who nobly do one of the most noble things in history and betray their class, you know, like Tolstoy in 19th century Russia. You know, he was a rich aristocrat, but he was an anarchist and he was really cool. And he also wrote well, War and Peace, etc. But so the psychology actually is very important. It's part of what's going on. I mean, we are confused, we are desperate, we are miserable, we blame ourselves, and that's makes us even better victims. Now, again, victim is like, oh, God, he's saying that we're victim. Oh, here's a whiny, you know, liberal. No, I'm not a liberal. I'm a radical. And we are being attacked. And we must fight back by any means necessary, as the great Malcolm X said.
Mm-hmm.
Look
how he ended up, poor guy.
I'm at awe before people like that. Like, again, you know, he was talking yesterday, we heard the son of Martin Luther King, and, you know, they shot him. Why did they shoot him? They shot him when he started not only dealing, significantly moving beyond civil rights for African Americans, and started to call for solidarity.
Exactly.
The poor, the foreigners. Justice, social justice, specifically economic justice. When you call for economic justice and you got a movement behind you, you get shot. I'm always nauseated by the watered down version of MLK that are celebrated in our school system, you know,
despite this
brave, magnificent radical that he was. And you know, people forget, you know, Rosa Parks didn't just one day decide that she had enough. She was going to meetings. She was organized. She was a left-wing agitator, and she was the one who was decided by the group to go and do it.
Right.
And get whatever the consequences. People forget that passive, peaceful resistance requires that you get beat up by the police. You know, that's how it works.
She's totally a national hero. And there's so many of them.
But we think as an individual, she just thought, no, she was a bunch of, let's say it like it is, left-wing socialists, you know? It's a dirty word today, and there's plenty of nasty socialists out there and plenty of fake socialists above all, and most notably the historical horrible caricature of Soviet, who was about as socialist as, I don't know, you know, they weren't, you know, they made the pictures, they waved the flags, but they didn't do the policies. And today we equate that tradition. Maybe for a future show, I want to say that probably the most socialistic place in America is Silicon Valley. I'm not talking about them being liberals, because Google runs its company like Karl Marx thought companies should be run, in the sense of the workers own it significantly, if not entirely, obviously, but have, above all, decision-making ability. You don't parachute some dude that has only business and crookery background, but the people running the companies are computer people who understand their product. It used to be like that, you know? So I'm problematizing things. There's a lot of it's important. Maybe we should do some kind of ideology breakdown at some point. But as I see the time, let's get back to the cliff. We didn't even play a song, am I? But so what? So we'll compromise? Before, after, under duress, at some point there'll be the compromise. And that is, I think, worse than the cliff. You see, the cliff, once again, just like in the election, we are to choose between miserable and horrible. You know, and miserable is a little better than horrible, you know?
Now since we are running out of time, our conversation before we got on the air, this is my way of giving you a little bit of therapy, but how would you apply the fiscal crisis here in the United States with the mess that's going on right now between Israel and Palestine? Because as you know, there's going to be a point where our country is going to be divided on whether we should go ahead and, you know, back whoever it is, and there goes a whole bunch of money that it basically is going to go and annihilate people on either side. And it seems to me that, you know, maybe, you know, I dream about John Lennon last night and all that, and I'm trying to be a idealist, which is really my biggest fault. But it seems to me that at one point we're going to have to put our foot down and say, hey, we're in problems. You know, our pocket is empty. You obviously been arguing this situation for the longest time. Go and sit down, have a drink. Go sit down, have a drink, and square off the differences and cut off the massacres you're doing. What's your take on that?
Yeah,
the fiscal cliff. How does it apply?
The connection is that the compromise that we will get if we don't go over the cliff, or probably we'll get after we go over the cliff, or who knows, but at some point we'll get that compromise. It's a horrible compromise. Instead of taking it off from those who can afford it, who benefited from so many, literally took trillions in bailout and indirect bailout. It's not only $500 billion that the banksters got from us. It's trillions, you know, in other ways, and continue to get it every day. And then our debt, I mean, they're collecting interest off of it, you know? Bankers, they snorted it all up. Right, 30 years of hard labor, and they're not the hard laborers, by the way. Let's stop with that taboo of like, oh, CEO got a lot of money because he works so hard. Unlike that poor sod, you know, working in the factory. They don't work hard. You know what the meaning of work is. And we'll take it off of their backs. So we bailed them out. And then we got into deficit by bailing them out, right? Or at least it's a significant one extra part to the deficit. And then who lends us the money? Yeah, the Chinese too. And the wealthy of the world lend the government the money and collect interests on the money. You know, you get it?
Right,
right. We gave them the money that they lost, right? And we got into debt. So what do? So they lend us back the money that we gave them that they lost and collect interest on it. I mean, it's like, you would believe that, how does it even happen? It happens that we don't have a middle class anymore. But it's, you know, it's been gutted so that the rulers, just like pre-capitalist world, you know, our masters in the castle, can get away with anything they want.
Right.
And they just, you know, rape and pillage.
You know, the beauty of the way they do it is that most people, you know, not paying attention or unaware of what they're doing. But they're no different than the loan shark that used to live down the street in my borough in Brooklyn.
Oh, yes, they are. They're much worse.
They're much worse, because at least the loan shark, you know where they live and you know when they were going to come around and collect the money. Yeah. And, you know, more than likely they break your leg, but they'll give you an extension on
your
loan.
No, these guys are come along, you know, they take your money, they break your legs, they kill you, and they dance on your grave, you know, and then we celebrate them for it.
Exactly.
You know, that's the cynical element. But the compromise will mean that we won't cut military, we'll continue our addiction, if you will, to imperial economics, which is a dead end. You know, history teaches us that, because it's actually, we could have a show on that alone. It's an untenable model. You run out. So you got to retool, or you will decline or even collapse. That's history. You know, 1,000 years of history, imperial history of empires shows us that. You know, we got to change the model. It doesn't last too long. And the compromise will be to take it off the back of the working people, you know, working families, to take it off the back of the 99% or... that'll be the compromise. And again, I mean, and to go to the horrible thing, and I'm like really depressed with what's going on, because I do actually have a background, you know, the old country, Israel for me.
And I have brothers there too. I'm an honorary Jew, like I was telling you.
Honorary Jew. Doubtful honor, right? No, I'm a proud Jew, but I'll say that I'm critical, very critical about the policies of the state of Israel. And a lot of Israelis are. That's another element, you know, people don't know that over 70% want the freeze to settlement. The thing that Romney was saying that Obama's being anti-Israeli about, because Romney is a buddy of a president that is about as popular as syphilis. He's like, I 8% or something. I mean, ridiculous. And in fact, that's one of the big reasons of this war. It's an electoral war.
Right.
And again, and the people suffer. And the people who make these decisions, who making the money off of wars, including the one that's going on, it's not a war because war implies two armies. This is closer to a massacre because you have the fifth biggest army in the world claiming to defend itself but against a bunch of thugs living within one of the poorest spot on planet Earth, Gaza. And I disagree with their strategies, frankly,
sure.
but it's no threat. I mean, I remember living significant part of my life over there. We would joke about how Americans talk about, existential threat. I'm like, existential threat? We can conquer the Middle East, and we can take on Europe, you know? we're that big, we're that powerful. But anyway, it's an example, certainly, of some people, very small minorities, cynically getting wealthy, getting power, deriving benefit on the backs of everybody else. And that includes the Palestinians who are dying like flies right now. The given that the Palestinians are so weak, even when they do, which I think really is the very wrong thing to do, lob those missiles into Israel, so they just killed, you know, many less. I mean, generally, because of the difference in power, Palestinians kill orders of magnitude less people than Israelis kill Palestinians. But the people are dying. The leadership doesn't give a damn.
Right.
In fact, there's profits in people dying. And once again, you know, so we get to the fiscal cliff. We have problems, but we're playing games instead of dealing with what would, you know, reconstruct American capitalism. And since we are running out of time, the bottom line is distribution of income.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
Going from feudalism to capitalism, the market system, capitalism, the word came later, was a matter of power to the middle class,
mm-hmm.
And not to the lords in the castle. And as over the past 30 years, the wealth siphoned up completely from the middle class to the upper classes, when we have a distribution of income that we reach at some point in the 20s, and you know what happened to us then, but otherwise is reminiscent of really pre-revolutionary France, you can't have capitalism. Capitalism cannot work with that kind of distribution. So that's really the focus of saving, you know, if we are indeed attached to this little market system of ours, that the record shows it's not perfect, but over the past 200 years, it did some remarkable benefits to a hell of a lot of people.
And at that note,
we're messed up anyway, you know?
Yeah, I know. But
but we fight nonetheless. We continue.
Right, because we're Americans.
No, not fight like, you know, we fight for justice because we are people.
Well,
because we have to, because otherwise it's going to be horrible.
I really hope so that, you know, we're just a small little station and small little program, but I hope that, you know, those of you that are listening to our program here on WPRK 91.5, Winter Park, that you share the knowledge out there with your neighbors and co-workers, because most of us just don't really have a time to pay attention. And sometimes listening to your girlfriend or your co-worker, sometimes it opens up your eyes. You go like, maybe I should be a little bit nicer to the person out there. Maybe I should start contacting my politician and let them know that, I do like living good, but we need to start spreading the wealth.
Solidarity,
mm-hmm. That's right. And on that note, we're going to leave you with The Clash, and basically mm-hmm. explains, you know, the people that are actually doing all the negative stuff. This one is called Police and Thieves.
That's a good one.
Okay, folks, I guess The Clash had decided to strike, trying to prove their point as always. I'll just let you know that there is another program coming up, and of course, they will definitely attribute. Yeah, next time we'll definitely bring you several songs, and we are definitely going to bring a guest. And I also want to let you know that, we really thank Dr. King to coming to our school. I mean, that was really inspirational. I did speak with him. I had the pleasure of and honor to have a short conversation with him. And he told me that he's going to contact the station, and hopefully maybe we can bring him here and interview him, and hopefully we can get some callers to talk to him, because he's almost just like his dad, but he's a little bit more on the kumbaya side, and he definitely brings a lot of knowledge and a lot of
mindfulness that we all need here. I did record the lecture last night, and hopefully he will also give me an approval so I can rebroadcast the lecture that was held here at Rollins College. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to Punkonomics here on WPRK, the voice of Rollins College and the best in basement radios. And